I think a lot of students think that what we're talking about is making them more productive, that they're wasting time on their phones. And I would like try to impress upon them, like, that is the last thing in the world I care about, actually. Like, I don't care how productive you are. I care how happy you are. And I care about how rich your life is. And that I think there are so many things on our phones that offer us a simulacrum of something real. There's so many easy, convenient ways to do something that feels like friendship, but lacks the spontaneity, lacks the sensory richness, lacks all the other ways we communicate besides through words.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. I really enjoyed this opportunity to speak with Mac Haygood, author of Hush, Media, and Sonic Self-Control, to explore how we use sound to manage our minds, moods, and modern lives. From white noise apps and noise-canceling headphones to tinnitus and sound therapy, Mac helped me understand the complex relationship between media, technology, and the human need to tune in or out. We discussed the surprising cultural history behind everyday sonic tools, from the 1964 Sleepmate sound conditioner to Irv Tybel's Visionary Environments recordings, to Amal Gopal Bose's 1978 flight epiphany that led to noise-canceling headphones. Mac reflected on teaching the smartphone in society and concerns with both social media and streaming platforms. Towards the end of this conversation, he explained why he started his podcast, Phantom Power, and how his childhood in New Orleans eventually led him to the new field of sound scholarship. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the show notes of this episode, where you'll find linked episodes and different ways to support this podcast. Listen now and rethink the sounds you live with. Hey, Mac, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
We're going to be talking about a lot of things, actually not directly related to music, but I do see a whole bunch of guitars behind you in your home office.
Yeah, I do have a weakness for guitars. And I was actually a little surprised that you invited me because, yeah, I am not, primarily known as a musician. So I was very interested to get your invitation.
Yeah, it's a little bit off the beaten track, but I do try to have some academics on because I'm a super nerd. I was very interested in your research because it affected me personally, and also to show people that the world of music is really broad and interesting, and all kinds of musicians do all kinds of things. And you are a guitarist.
I am a guitarist. I started playing guitar when I think I was 12. My mom got remarried, and my stepdad, Skip Capron, had a really nice old Gibson L5 guitar, kind of like, I don't know, World War II era guitar, maybe before that actually, and with the sort of F holes. And he was a guy who loved like the Kingston Trio and Bob Dylan and that generation. And I just picked it up, fell in love with it. I had no idea what a really marvelous instrument I was getting to play. It has this very old time percussive sound to it. But yeah, so that's kind of what I learned on. I'm pretty much self-taught, which has definitely caused problems over the years. But yeah, I wouldn't call myself like a trained musician, but I play music.
And when I was looking up, like you recorded with this Americana group, Pine Top Seven. So I found some of their stuff on YouTube. Is that, were you on some of those recordings?
I was on the last few things that came out. And it was a real privilege to play with those guys because they really were some great musicians. Yeah, Darren Richard was the leader of that group, and he's a really great singer-songwriter who, I don't know, his music just sort of evoked wide open spaces, and his lyrics are excellent, and he just attracted a really great bunch of musicians. Nate Walcott, the trumpet player who went on to play with Bright Eyes, a very prominent band in that kind of space. Melissa Bach, a great cello player out of Chicago. Andy Rader played upright bass. Ned Folkirth on drums, and I was playing guitar, electric guitar. Yeah, it was a great experience.
So I found you because I was researching Joel Stuyzens a few months ago. And for, yeah, I'll link his episode if people haven't heard it. So he suffers from tinnitus and hyperacusis and changed his music career. So you had some of his music on this episode you did about tinnitus. It was a solo episode. And when I was listening to it, it was a big aha moment for me because I've had tinnitus for years, but I didn't understand how. I'd never researched it. I just put up with it. And I figured all the variability was just the condition changing. Like I didn't understand. So I will want to talk to you about tinnitus. And I actually it might be interesting to dive into your, well, you know, we should maybe it relates, but your book, Hush, what's your Media and Sonic Self-Control? I read that book this summer and took notes, so I have some specific questions about it.
Wow, thank you for reading
Yeah. But
that.
maybe we should just dive into tinnitus because I bet a lot of listeners have it and may not even realize what they're hearing.
Well, gosh. So yeah, it could be pronounced tinnitus or
Okay.
tinnitus. I pronounced it tinnitus until I started doing field work and
Okay.
studying it, and then all the clinicians I was working with were pronouncing it tinnitus, so now that's how I pronounce it. But it is, the experience of ringing, buzzing, or other phantom sounds perceived to be in the head or ears. And generally, there are some kinds of tinnitus that are, or some clinicians call them somatosound, where it's actually there is a pulse or some bodily mechanical thing that's happening that you're just perceiving that you can hear. So often that's like called pulsatile tinnitus, where you can hear a pulse in your ears. But for musicians, generally, what we tend to experience is just, straight up tinnitus that has no cause in the physical world that we can perceive. And there's nothing wrong with tinnitus. I always want to just begin by saying that. Like, so if you experience tinnitus, there's no reason to sort of like problematize it in your mind. It is a very, very common experience. And in fact, there's this classic study where they put individually 100 people, one by one, into one of those silent chambers, an anechoic chamber. And I think like 98 of them heard tinnitus when they were in that space. So basically, what happens is the auditory system is very much like the pupil. When you're in a low light situation, the pupil dilates. It wants to get more light, like its job is to see. So if you put it in a situation where it can't see, it's going to do its best to see. Well, the auditory system is the same way. And so it, basically, when there's an absence of sound, the brain turns up the volume. And what winds up happening is it's just like if you took a stereo system that, you weren't playing any music on and you just crank the volume all the way up, you're going to hear the inherent noise of the system. And so what happens is the auditory system kind of perceives the random neuronal firing that's happening in our brains all the time. That's actually the signal for silence. Well, it experiences it as sound. And that sound can be perceived in different ways. Often, what we perceive is frequencies that are sort of in the neighborhood of spaces where we maybe have lost a little bit of hearing. And so there's often a relationship between hearing loss, and it could be a tiny, tiny amount of hearing loss, and tinnitus. That's not always the case, but it's often the case. And so basically, your brain might be turning up the volume just in those frequencies that you don't hear quite as well. And I think this happens to musicians for maybe a couple of reasons. One reason would be that, quite often our ears take a beating. If you're, playing and you're like the brass section is behind you, like you're catching some major decibels there. And we know that volume over time is what leads to hearing loss, right? So the louder the sound is, the shorter your exposure should be. And I think education has gotten a lot better on that front. I think people know about musicians' earplugs now that have a real nice flat frequency response, still let you feel very much in contact with the music, but maybe mitigate some of that hearing damage that can happen. But the second reason I think musicians often suffer from tinnitus is simply that our like if you looked at our brains, the portion dedicated to sound perception is just much more developed, right? Like and so there's just this very discerning auditory system that notices these things. And then what can be bad is when basically our other parts of our brain get involved, and we get maybe like a perception like, oh my gosh, is this bad? What does this mean? Am I losing my hearing, or am I ill, or like what is that? And then a sort of fight or flight reaction can develop, and that's when people can start to actually suffer from tinnitus instead of just merely experiencing it.
Yes. Yeah, I've noticed that change with myself, and it's very interesting. And also I hear like sometimes it's a high pitch, and that's clearly what that is. And I will now say tinnitus.
Okay, I'm agnostic. I'm just going to say tinnitus, but you
It
can
could
say
be,
tinnitus.
yeah, it could be a tomato tomato kind of
Totally.
situation. But I do have like crackling and other sounds that come and go. And you know when I really started noticing it, Mac, was when we had the pandemic lockdowns and I suddenly wasn't in rehearsal. I was stressed out. I was home alone in this very quiet, pretty quiet house. And I really started noticing I was craving. So I started using like nature sounds and just to have something on in the background when I was trying to do other things. And it's the first time I'd really sought that out.
I mean that rings true to me. No pun intended. I mean, I think a lot of people either first noticed tinnitus or kind of found it to become problematic for them during the pandemic. And I think you put your finger on it. It was the actual lack of sonic enrichment that we were getting, the quietness. I mean, there was these fascinating phenomena that happened during the pandemic. Like people started Googling, why are the birds so loud? And of course, the birds didn't change their volume. It's just that the world got so quiet that suddenly we could hear them, and people started being annoyed by the birds. It's like, wow, they sound so aggressive. It's like, no, I think we were the aggressive ones. We've been drowning out their mating calls like, for all of these years, and they're finally able to hear one another. But, some of the things that we were able to hear were like the sound of our own brains, and that's not always so fun. And I've myself have suffered from tinnitus, and had times in my life where I was very affected by it and dealt with depression over it, much like Joel Stuyzen's. And so I have, I was pretty passionate about into my research on this topic and really trying to understand it and really trying to contextualize it in the culture more broadly. Not only like what are the noises that maybe make us, harm our hearing, that is one aspect, but I was more interested in like why does it feel so threatening or dangerous or isolating to experience this sound. And so I wound up doing a lot of reading on the history of tinnitus and thinking about like that, why it is that our in our present culture, tinnitus is so bothersome.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember one thing in this early pandemic days, I actually Googled cafe sounds, like to have background noise because I mm-hmm. miss going to a cafe. Mm-hmm. And if anyone's interested, it's definitely up there, like 10 hours of like the murmur and coffee cups and background noise. It's a lot less expensive maybe than going out sometimes. If that's, yeah. if you're seeking that sort of hubbub, you know, to concentrate.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that kind of content out there. And that is yeah. like, you know, one of my research interests is like, what are those sounds doing for us? Why do we crave them so much? And I suppose just to sort of like answer the question, at least to some extent, I think because we live in a culture where we are responsible for ourselves, you know, we're no longer in an environment where most of us get one job and have that job for life, right? Like we're all free agents in this economy. You know, it's often called neoliberalism. You know, it's this kind of like lack of a safety net and great opportunities in some regards, right? But also a great responsibility to the individual. And so our control of our own attention becomes very important in that scenario, right? I mean, it really separates who can be a high earner from who can't. And no matter what kind of sphere you're trying to be excellent in, you need to be able to control your own attention. And so tinnitus is sort of like a threat to that, right? Like it's a sound that's attached to yourself and you can't get rid of it. And I think that's part of what adds to the angst around it in contemporary life. And then moreover, the reason why we use things like the cafe sounds that you're talking about, or noise canceling headphones, or white noise machines, or any of the things that I studied in that book you mentioned, Hush, Media and Sonic Self-Control. All of these are sonic tools that we use to help control our own attention, whether we want to relax and chill or concentrate and get our work done.
So I wanted to ask you about some specific things in the book. Let's talk about the 1964, the Sleepmate, this electromechanical sound conditioner. It's kind of a funny story.
Yeah, yeah. There's a mythology within the company, which I believe they're now called Yoga Sleep, but at the time that I was studying them, they were called Marpac. They've had a few names. But within the company, there was this sort of like this myth, or I mean, I think there was some truth to the story. I'm just not 100% yeah. sure which version is true. But basically, the idea was that the Buckwalter, the couple that founded the company, the Buckwalters, were sleeping in a roadside motel in the early 60s. And there's different versions of this story, but basically there might have been a poker game going on in the room next door all night, or it might have just been there was noise from cars on the highway. But whatever the scenario was, they couldn't sleep. And there was a sort of air conditioner in the window of the room, and they had the insight that, you know, if this air conditioner wasn't broken, which it was, they would be able to sleep just fine because they would have had the sound of the air conditioner. And James Buckwalter was a tinkerer. He was the guy who invented the rubber floor mats for automobiles. He used to work for the Rubbermaid Corporation as a salesman, but also, you know, invented a few things himself. And so when he got home from this trip, he took a piece of plywood and like cut out a circular piece of plywood, and he got a tin dish.
Like a dog dish or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it would. It turns out maybe it wasn't actually a dog okay. dish. This is another point of contention in the lore of the company. But yeah, it was just like sort of like a, Yeah, it could have been a dog dish. It was like a tin dish, and he got a church key and he punched a few holes in it. And then he got a motor from like a fan that you would I think it was sort of like the kind of fan that you would have in your bathroom or something like that, but he just had the motor for it. And then he took a coffee can and cut out some fan blades and put this under the dish on top of the plywood base and plugged it in, and it made this whoosh. And they put it on their bedside table and it helped them sleep. And they were like, oh, this is a pretty cool idea. And then they would tell their friends about it, and all of their friends wanted one. And so they wound up making this electromechanical sound machine. You know, we basically would probably just call it a white noise machine. And they called it a sound conditioner. That's sort of the way they marketed it. And these are the kinds of things that you know, if you've ever been to like a therapist's office, and they might have one in the hallway so that the people in the who are in the waiting room can't hear the emoting going on inside the therapist's office. So I think these are pretty familiar things. A lot of people use them for their babies, that sort of thing.
And then it was sort of like a family when it started. They had the kids assembling these in the garage, like a, and I also found the marketing interesting. It was kind of gendered because they had like the young man studying, and it was the same product, but it was named differently. And then the woman on her bed trying to sleep.
Yeah, they marketed they it was very interesting. I mean, one of the big breakthroughs that they had was they got it into the Sears and Roebuck catalog, which was a huge deal back in that time before the internet. I mean, these big thick catalogs were kind of the in terms of commerce, they were the internet before the internet, right? And so just to get their product in there was a huge deal. And they did use these very gendered imagery of women, always white women, sleeping peacefully next to this machine. And they called the machine the Sleepmate. That was the brand that they used. But then they started to get letters from people who were using the machine at work. And these folks felt that Sleepmate did not seem very professional, and they didn't want that in their office. And so basically they just took it and they put a different badge on top of the machine that said Soundscreen. And so they had the identical product that they just marketed two different ways and sold to two different audiences.
Yeah. And okay, let's see. There's so many interesting, like I should say it's a fairly academic book, but there's so many interesting stories within it. And Irv Teibel, what a character, and his Environment series, which I did find on YouTube. You can check out the original.
Well, I should mention that actually I agree with you that it is a pretty academic book, and I was sort of frustrated by that because I would go out and give talks about the book, and everyone had stories to tell me about like how they can't live without their noise canceling headphones or their white noise machine, or like every time I would go give a talk on another campus about this, I got such a response from the audience, and I was like, why didn't I write this book in a way that would have been more accessible to a wider audience? And of course, the reason is because I needed to get tenure as a professor, and you have to do certain things. But so I actually found an agent, and I have a book contract with Penguin Press to write a public-facing version of this story that really focuses a lot more on the stories of how these things were invented and the sort of more, broader cultural implications of them, but is not so academic. So hopefully that'll be coming out in the next couple of years.
Okay.
Irv Teibel, yeah, his Environment series was the first series that basically the first record series that used nature sounds as, what I call a technology of the self. I pull that term from the theorist Foucault, who talks about how there were certain kinds of technologies or practices that people use to help them withstand the pressures of modern life. And so the environment series had titles like Wood-Masted Sailboat, Ultimate Seashore, Country Stream, and they had these really extensive liner notes that told you, like, you know, what speed to play the record at and like how to, you're supposed to listen to them by not listening to them. So basically they were like, the concept was you don't listen to these records, you hear them. And Irv Teibel, who came up with this concept, had all of these really rather extraordinary claims printed on the records. They would double your reading speed. They would make sex better. They would make your plants grow faster. It's like, it's a pretty like sort of hippy dippy early 70s, like pet rock kind of weird, you know, kitschy thing on one level. But on another level, like, we kind of live in the sonic world that he invented. I mean, everywhere you look now, there are environmental sounds being used. Like, they come stock. I bought a new TV, and like, they're just like a setting that you can turn on the TV. There's a bajillion YouTube channels and Spotify recordings and podcasts that play this kind of stuff. So he was definitely ahead of his time.
And I might be mixing him up with somebody else in the book, but these loops were manipulated in such a way that they didn't sound looped, right? Because the recordings weren't as long as the final track.
Yeah. So for his first record, which was the Psychologically Ultimate Seashore, he had a problem because he had these 3 minutes of ocean wave sounds that he recorded at Coney Island that sounded just beautiful. And they're what gave him the entire idea. He was actually there to record sounds for an avant-garde film being made by, some folks in the audience will know, Tony Conrad, who was sort of an associate of the Velvet Underground and an experimental musician. And also a filmmaker, and who recently passed away a couple of years ago. But I got to interview him about his side of this whole story. So basically, he's the one who brought Teibel out to the beach to record some ocean waves for his film that he was making called Coming Attractions. And they record these sounds, and Teibel's very reluctant because it's winter and it's cold, and Conrad's trying to make him go out into the ocean, and he doesn't want to. He thinks, I could have just faked these sounds in my studio. Why are you making me come out here? But then he gets home and he plays the tape, and most of it has like noise, like his own voice complaining and things like that, or traffic or planes flying overhead. But there's like just a few minutes that are just the ocean and in stereo. And it's hard for us to appreciate today how new that was. Like this was, you have to remember that the late 60s was really just at the dawn of the era where you could make a mobile recording that was truly high fidelity. Mm-hmm. And so this was really a new thing to have this amazing sound of the ocean through headphones. And he was blown away by it. And then he just basically overnight had this whole idea of this whole record series. But the problem was he only had 3 minutes of music. And to make a long story short, he goes all up and down the eastern seaboard trying to get more perfect ocean sounds. And he could never get another good recording. For whatever reason, apparently Coney Island, the beach was dredged right after he made that recording, and it changed the sounds of the waves. And so he wound up with the help of a colleague of his who worked at Bell Laboratories. They actually ran the recording through a mainframe computer, and it's a very technical, I won't really go into all the details, but they basically made a 45-minute recording out of the 3 minutes using the help of a computer. And it's actually the first digital recording that was like a popular recording, and people don't even realize that.
Yeah, I found that really Fascinating. And, you know, for anyone who's younger, who's listening, maybe in their 20s, they may not realize what a computer was in that time. It would have been like a whole room, right?
It was a whole room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite a weird story. And I've been having fun writing about it for the new book and sort of getting into the characters. And, you know, it's a different challenge to write a book for the public, you know, because the characters have to take the foreground. So there was a whole new level of research and thinking that I had to do about, like, well, what drove these people and how to characterize them, you know?
Yeah. I look forward to reading the new book.
Thank you.
Well, another character, Dr. Amar Gopal Bose, 1978, goes on a flight. And he's a I found it interesting that he was a violinist as well as, what was he, a mechanical engineer? I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, so Bose is this, you know, beloved MIT professor. His classes were known for not only, you know, instilling technical knowledge, but also just sort of like life lessons. And, but way before that, when he was just a kid, he grew up in Philadelphia, and he too was a tinkerer, and he loved to fix old radios in his basement. And he spent a lot of time in his basement because his dad was from India, and his mom was, I don't remember where she was from, but she was a white woman. And the racism at the time was really bad in Philadelphia, among other places. And so basically he was often chased through the streets and called the N-word. And so he spent just a lot of time in his basement tinkering with things. And he was a bit of an autodidact. Apparently it was, you know, not a sure thing that he was going to get into a place like MIT, but eventually he did. And he became the great, you know, person we've heard of, these, you know, Bose radios and Bose headphones and all of these things. But I think it was in, I'm forgetting what year it is right now, but it was in the 70s. He was on a flight, and he was really looking forward to this flight because it was sort of the debut of the headphones that you could plug into the armrest. And these were not the ones that, this is going to really, only certain people are going to remember this, but there used to be these weird earphones that looked like a stethoscope that you would put into your ears that were like pneumatic tubes that the sound would come through, and they sounded horrible and they looked absurd. And so then the big excitement was that these were more like Walkman headphones that plugged into the armrest, and it was an electronic connection. And so Bose was really excited to try them. He put them on. He put on some classical music, and he was instantly disappointed because of the airplane noise, he had to crank up the headphones so loud that they distorted, and the violin was sounding more like, you know, the guitar of Jimi Hendrix or something. And as a violinist, he knew what a violin should sound like. And he was one of these folks that, you know, some scholars of technology would call like a cultural intermediary. He occupied these two different spaces. He understood the aesthetics of music. He knew what music should sound like. He knew what music sounded like unmediated in person. But then he was also an acoustical engineer who knew how to do schematics, and he knew electronics, and he knew how to build things. And so up until that time, at least in his opinion, a lot of speakers in hi-fi systems, they made sense on paper. They made sense from an engineer's perspective, but they didn't actually sound the way the music should sound, in his opinion. And so he became this innovator in the space of acoustic design. And then when he was on that flight, so frustrated because of the sound of the distorted violins, he was like, you know, there must be some way you can subtract things you don't want from things you want. And he took out a piece of paper and a pen, And he started doing these equations that proved active noise cancellation was possible. And so right then, he invented on that flight noise canceling headphones, but it would take, you know, well over a decade for him to actually bring them into fruition. In fact, it was decades, because it wasn't until, you know, the early 2000s that they really came out on the consumer market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember the first flight when I was able to use them, what a difference it made.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Something you mentioned about this, how he knew how sound should be, brings me to another little comment you had in the book, the reference to the Edison, what was it called, realism test.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really interesting that people in the early years of the phonograph, it was weird for them that there would be a sound and not a person in the room making it.
Yeah, it's another one of those things. And folks in the kind of, you know, subfield that I'm in called sound studies, love to talk about this Edison realism test, because it shows how culturally influenced and environmentally influenced our listening is. People think sound has a history, right? Like there was a quiet past, and then there was the Industrial Revolution, and then there was noise, and now we live in a noisy world, and of course we need noise canceling headphones because it's a noisy world. But in the discipline of sound studies, or the interdiscipline, you know, we have folks from anthropology and history and all these different, you know, humanities disciplines who are thinking about sound and pointing out, well, actually, listening has a history too. And so when something like the phonograph gets invented, that changes our listening. It doesn't just change the soundscape, it changes the way we listen. And the proof of that is things like this Edison, you know, realism test, where basically it was teaching people how to listen to a record, how to listen to music without being able to see a musician. This was a rather uncanny experience. It was the same thing for the telephone. A lot of people were pretty freaked out hearing the voice of somebody without being able to see that person. And in fact, there was a lot of, you know, we get the rise of spiritualism and a whole lot of things like that once these audio technologies come out. And there's sort of a direct influence there. This idea that you could hear voices from virtually, what feels like out of thin air, really got people thinking in a very spiritual way, I guess you could say.
And did some people use recordings covertly as part of their seance or whatever?
Oh yeah, I think almost certainly there was that kind of trickery going on. Yeah. But there was also earnest, you know, like belief that people could. It reminds me of the way a lot of very smart people talk about AI right now, it either is or is going to be some kind of, you know, actual thinking entity that we can communicate with and is going to change the world. I mean, this is the way Edison was thinking about sound. Like he was working on something like called the spirit phone, where we were going to be able to somehow use a telephone to communicate with the great beyond and talk to our deceased relatives and stuff like that.
That's interesting that he would have thought that way. I thought of him as being so scientific, but
yeah, yeah. But that's, you could say the same of Elon Musk, yeah. But he's clearly a lot of other things besides rational.
Yeah. Well, my sister's an anthropologist, and I did take a few anthropology courses as for fun as a music student. So it's interesting, some stuff that came up, and you mentioned the interdisciplinary aspect of sound studies. One of the things was that many languages don't distinguish noise as a category of sound.
Yeah, that's something I learned from an ethnomusicologist named Dave Novak. It was something that he mentioned in a book called Keywords in Sound. I don't have a lot to say about that
Yeah.
beyond that, but it's, but it, yeah, it's, it does show once again how culturally conditioned our ways of listening are. You know, I often like to tell my students, like, we think we hear the world directly, like we have a clean signal. And as an electric guitarist with, you know, a weakness for guitar pedals, you know, I like to say, like, actually in our signal chain, we have a bunch of delays and distortions and echoes and reverbs and like all of these different things that are affecting the way we actually hear the world. Those are culturally conditioned, but physically embodied ways of listening. You know, I think classically trained musicians will know, like there are certain kinds of modes of listening, you know, for slight variations in pitch or timbre that you're not born with those things, right? You become soaked in them.
Yeah.
Hi, just a really quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes. I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with Joel Stuyzens, Verna Gillis, Karen Power, Leif Karlstrom, and Lawrence English. In the show notes, you'll also find a link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get exclusive information about upcoming guests, a link for my Ko-fi page to support this project directly, where you can buy me one coffee or every month, and my podcast merchandise store with a design commissioned from artist Steffi Kelly. You can also review this podcast, share it with your friends, and follow on your podcast app, YouTube, and social media. All this helps spread the word. Thanks. Now, back to my conversation with Mac.
And the subject of soundscapes and field recordings has come up with several of my guests. Oh. And I actually took a course with Murray Schafer when I was a student.
Oh, wow.
Like with his book about soundscapes, The Tuning of the World, I think it was.
Oh, what was that like?
Well, he was a visiting professor at McGill, so he wasn't living in Montreal. I mean, it's one class and he had to catch a train, so because he had to go back to where he was living. So he said, okay, meet me on the steps of the music building and this will be the class. And then we show up and he just put his suitcase down and he looked at his whatever, the graduate student was helping him, and just expected him to carry the suitcase, which is kind of like 20 minute walk or whatever, to the train station. Then we got there. He said, okay, I want everyone to close their eyes and just listen. And that's your assignment. I'm going to go catch my train. And that was like the lecture. He was kind of like that, you know.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, I actually, on my podcast, Phantom Power, we did a 2-part series on him, which really gave a good faith sounding out of both his musical output and his, you know, sort of more theoretical work. But the second part was really looking at a lot of the sort of contradictions and maybe more problematic areas with his work. So, you're not the first person to say something negative about R. Murray Schafer to me. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I interviewed Ellen Waterman, who had worked with him quite a bit.
I interviewed her too for that piece. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not as familiar with his music, but I certainly, that reading the book and the course, I got a lot out of it. And I do remember one of the very first lectures where there was just like a painting, like an old painting, and he asked us to imagine all the sounds in the scene. And I had never thought that way before. And quite a few people I've interviewed have been influenced, you know, by and have worked with Pauline Oliveros. So sure. This sort of stuff has come up. But what I find interesting about field recordings, you know, when you listen to them, like a really good field recording, it just transports you.
Yeah.
In a different way than music. It's, yeah, it can be very special.
And it's also really interesting that when I go back and listen to a field recording I did a long time ago, it's like I instantly know that spot. Like I'm like, oh yeah, like, and it could be a place I haven't thought of in many, many years. And then I hear that, I'm like, oh yeah, I was right there. And it's a very unusual, like, teleportation technology, you know.
Yeah, I'll be linking a few episodes for people. I'll mention Karen Power, the Irish composer and field recordist, is probably a very interesting episode for the listeners of this one. And also the Australian Lawrence English, who
runs. Oh, yeah. We've had him on,
okay.
on Phantom Power. Yeah. He's remarkable. Yeah.
So actually, you mentioned Phantom Power. We can get back to some other stuff. So I've listened to several episodes of your podcast. But in May of last year, you announced to listeners, this is the last episode. Yeah. I'm going to be doing something different. But you continued.
Yeah, that didn't last long at all. I was, frankly, with the book contract, you know, and the expectations around that, I was concerned about being able to do everything at once. And beyond that, I was also working on a scripted series about sound that we have completed a pilot episode for called How to Listen. And that was really, I mean, just that one episode, I think I did 6 drafts of the script before we even started recording and sound mm-hmm. designing and bringing in voice actors. It was like, there's a whole production involved in that. And so I just didn't think I had time for Phantom Power. But once I started to get a realistic sense of how long How to Listen was going to take to even just put one season out, I decided I just missed talking to people. And and then very strangely, like when I brought the show back, not long after that, I got contacted by a podcast network called Spectre Vision Radio, which is run by Daniel Noah and the actor Elijah Wood. It turns out, you know, they're huge. They're movie producers, but they're also like huge sound nerds. And so now I'm part of their network, and you know, my audience is growing, and it's been really cool. And to think that I almost quit putting the show out, you know.
Yeah. It is hard to get traction. I put so much time into publicity and trying to figure that out. I'm curious, do your students, like as an academic, is your podcast listening? Do they have to listen to episodes as part of assignments or?
Yeah. I have them listen to certain episodes in the context of, you know, and sort of in lieu of a reading or sometimes alongside a reading. A lot of folks use Phantom Power in that way. I've gotten a lot of emails from people all over the world who are using the show in the classroom. So that's really gratifying. And part of the reason that I didn't want to stop, you know, doing it. I think at this point I've kind of, in the world of sound studies, people know about it. They know about this show. I've kind of hit a critical mass with that community. Mm-hmm. And so that feels really nice. It's fun to help people, you know. I mean, I feel like my mission in that show is just to help scholars and sound artists get the word out about what they're doing. Very similar to what you're doing in just sort of like an adjacent space, I think.
Yeah. I guess my show is, I think it's so broad that it's a little hard because it's not enough of a niche. You know, it's interesting because there's an accordion podcast and at least one mandolin podcast, and there's these very specific, it's fairly broad, although, you know, not so much pop music. But anyway, it's interesting because I've become aware of other podcasts that there might be some overlap with my listeners, and yours is definitely one of them. So mm-hmm. of course we'll be linking that. Before we get into, I had questions about a couple of your episodes, but just finishing about Hush, I know there was a couple things like 1979, first Walkman, which I remember, and you said that there were 2 headphone jacks because there was an idea that the Sony Corporation had about Japanese culture and the perception. I found that super interesting because we could use 2 headphone jacks. Now everything's Bluetooth, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. It is really fascinating. They just didn't think that people were necessarily going to feel comfortable being out in public listening to something on their own. It seemed a little antisocial. So they put the 2 headphone jacks on the Walkman, and, you know, eventually one fell off like the vestigial tail it was, I guess. But you know, it's interesting though, because oh gosh, I'm forgetting his name, but there is a scholar who actually studied sort of like iPod use among 8th graders, 7th graders, middle schoolers, like that. And he found that one of the ways that they sort of created, bonds between them, and friends, is to take the little earbuds and share them, and each one listening to, which I just thought was so sweet.
Yeah, I remember seeing that in movies and maybe with my daughters when they were younger, certainly one of them. I don't know if people do that now with their Bluetooth devices. They might. If you have, like, I don't know. But for those of us that use over ear headphones,
Yeah,
you
that's
can't do it.
impossible.
Yeah. And well, we talked a little bit about sound masking, but oh yeah, you interviewed a guy who developed one of the earliest apps, and it was interesting to me that people asked for very specific sounds, like someone got used to the sound of a hairdryer to sleep, and it was running hairdryers.
That this guy, I mean, the thing that interviewing these folks who were creating all of these nature sound apps, they were all just like, if I have to make another kind of rain, I'm gonna kill myself, because people want to rain on a tent, rain on a tin roof, rain on a slate, sidewalk or whatever. Like, there was just so many rain requests. But then there were also weird requests, which were just things that people had gotten used to and made them feel safe, made them feel relaxed. And I guess there was a woman who was using the sound of the hairdryer to help her sleep. And she mentioned that she had burned out so many hairdryers by leaving them running all night. And this guy was like, I can't put a hairdryer in my app. Like, people will criticize it and rate it poorly. But he was worried that she was gonna die in a fire. So he created some kind of mode where you could record whatever sound you wanted and then use it. I think that's the way he handled the hairdryer situation.
Yeah. Let's get into you teach a large class, the Smartphone in Society. Do you want to talk to us about that?
So the smartphone in society, on the one hand, it was sort of like an entry-level class that we thought would be a good, almost like Trojan horse for critical media studies, because there was like, here's a beloved object that every college student is very attached to. So what if we make a class about it? And then we can sort of bring in media theory and show how the humanities can help us have a deeper understanding of these everyday practices and technologies that we engage with. And I think it's been successful in that front. I mean, the class always fills up quickly, but as time has gone on and my students have become more and more, I mean, I've been teaching this class over a decade now, and the hours, I always make them monitor. Like, there's one assignment that they do early in the semester where they measure their screen time. They do sort of like an autoethnography of like what apps they use and why they use them and how many notifications they get, which is an insane number, a totally insane number. Like, some of them are getting like 800 plus notifications a day. I'm like, how does that, and so as time has gone on and this attachment has grown so strong, and that even they feel oppressed by it, I feel like the importance of this class has just grown and grown. And at this point, I think my main mission is just to help them sort of critically engage with their smartphone use and their social media use, and especially their TikTok use right now, at least. And find some agency. Find a little bit of control for them over this object, which has been so carefully designed to feed on their minds and suck every drop of attention and commerce that can be sucked out of them. And they sense it, you know, they're not completely naive. They're worried about their own smartphone use increasingly. And, so I just feel like I'm there to provide resources in dealing with that relationship.
You know, I should try to get sponsorship from this company I'm going to mention because they really helped me. Have you heard of the Brick?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So have you tried anything like that?
Mm-mm.
I got one. It's been about a month and it's really changed my relationship with my phone because you can really customize what you're blocking and it doesn't take any self-control because it's a like I'll brick my phone before I leave the house. So when I'm out, the apps I've blocked, I can't bring them up. And even if you try to look at, I was doing research actually on a podcast guest. So I was trying to look on like on Google for them and it was like their Facebook, but it wouldn't let me do it because I had Facebook blocked on my phone. So it's actually really, really good. And then, you know, apparently you can have many different accounts in a family. And so it's a physical thing. And when you lock your device, like you decide how you want to use it. So you could make your phone into just phoning and texting and get rid of the internet altogether, or just block very specific apps that you might have trouble with. So I find it very interesting because that whole issue where we're beating ourselves up because we're losing focus, it just removes that for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a cool idea around that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm all for things like that. I'm also, you know, I think a lot of students think that what we're talking about is making them more productive, that they're wasting time on, you know, their phones. And I would like try to impress upon them, like, that is the last thing in the world I care about, actually. Like, I don't care how productive you are. I care how happy you are. And I care about how rich your life is, and that I think there are so many things on our phones that offer us a simulacrum of something real. You know, there's so many easy, convenient ways to do something that feels like friendship, but lacks the spontaneity, lacks the sensory richness, lacks all the other ways we communicate besides through words. And, you know, I mean, there's no pheromones crossing the fiber optic cables and Wi-Fi signals of this great country, you know, we're missing out on all the sounds around us when we walk around with our headphones on. And I'm just all about that richness. And I honestly feel like the more I've gotten into this theme of research, the less of a trouble I have staying off my phone. I'm just like, actually, I don't really want to listen to music right now. I just want to hear what's going on around me. And the same thing with like social media, it's really lost its luster for me, especially now that so little of it comes from my actual friends, which makes me in some ways a terrible podcaster because I don't promote my show at all. Because I don't feel like, you know, like if I try to make a TikTok video, like I'm speaking a language that I don't speak, you know. I'm trying to do something that I actually don't engage with at all. So it's like, it's just looks completely false to people. Like, I don't even try because it would be so insincere. But what I love about podcasts is, like, I mean, you and I have never met before, but I feel like I'm getting to really know you and that. So I don't treat all media equally, right? I think they all have different shortcomings and bonuses but I tend to like podcasting a lot.
I'm curious, when you got into podcasting, was it partly because you had a love of like good radio and because you were sort of before the pandemic that you started, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was 2018.
Yeah.
So I was I'd finished Hush and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I'd had an idea of podcasting for a long time because I was a pretty early podcast listener. And I was frustrated that I was in this sound studies world, and then all of my work came out on the printed page or in pixels. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that just seems dumb. And so I was really like, well, how could we really do scholarship in sound? And since then, there's been some really great journals and so forth that are doing, like, there's one called Seismograph. It's a Danish journal. Their latest issue, the September issue, has 19 different audio articles, and they engage with music, but they're also like very anthropological. And the one that I was just writing up this morning for my newsletter is they have an article about the Great Asian Songbird Crisis. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
And so for folks who don't know, there's a huge market for sort of competitive songbird specimens or whatever. So like basically you train up your songbird, and there are these competitions that can be for a lot of money. And but the problem is, you know, these are like, I think, very powerful, like, bird human relationships, but they're also leading to the potential extinction of these songbirds in the wild, because people go out and capture them for this market. And so there's an anthropologist and a musicologist who made this 18-minute audio piece, and they went to Indonesia, they did their research, they spoke to all the people who are in these competitions, and the field recordings, like, bring you into the competitions, you can hear it. And they're saying, like, you know, us Westerners shaking our fingers, like, we don't really understand what's going on. Like, we need to talk to them and find out what the attraction is. And then, I mean, the fact is, these guys are loving these birds to death. They love the birds, you know? And so just to hear like a piece of audio scholar, I mean, that would have been interesting to read anyway, but to hear it, I think that is like what we should be doing in sound studies. Not that we shouldn't write at all, but to get our work out to the public, I think we should be working in sound more.
Mm-hmm. A couple of your episodes I found very interesting. It was with Carolyn Birdsall. And you spoke to her about her book Radiophilia and also her Nazi soundscape stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was just like a little thing in that discussion that you guys mentioned that I hadn't been aware of because I don't watch sports. It was during the pandemic, they used canned crowd sound to help both the players and the viewers at home.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just didn't, you know, when they first were trying to do pandemic era sports, I think they very quickly, I don't even know if they tried to do it without putting in canned sounds. Mm. And that was not the earliest time that those kinds of simulated sounds have been used. When you watch the Olympics and you're seeing like the cross country skiing or whatever, they can't get mics like way out there in the snow or what have you. And so they're putting in simulated sounds in there too. In fact, there was a great episode of the podcast 99% Invisible that talks about all the fake sounds in the Olympics. That was okay. Really great.
Yeah. That's another good podcast. Too many.
Oh, it's a really good one. Yeah.
Well, also I think for my listeners, Liz Pelly, her book Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Cost of the Perfect Playlist. Very apt. And this topic comes up with so many of my guests who are so frustrated by streaming platforms and the algorithms.
Are they frustrated because of the compensation or because of what it's doing to their music listening? What do folks say to you?
Well, of course, compensation, but I think a lot of it is discoverability because, well, we can get into the discussion about AI music, which is even separate.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, and I don't use Spotify, but they try to have this sort of chill vibe and to discourage people from actively finding music they like, and they'll feed you the most popular or what they think you want. Yeah. And when you look up an artist, you don't, even the way it's displayed, it's not like, here's their discography. They'll say, listen to this, right? So I think the way the algorithm works.
Yeah, I mean, it's this, I think, I can't remember which term Liz coined, but one of the things people call it is Spotify core. Mm-hmm. It's just this kind of very middle of the road, easy to have on in the background, and you know, shorter song lengths, like anything to create more conversions, more plays. It's really super interesting to think about the format of musical distribution affecting the content itself. But this has always been the case. You know, I mean, when we were, you know, with the gramophone, you know, like the wax cylinders could only hold so much music. So people had to condense their performance to that length. Or, you know, we have like the 45 RPM record could only hold, you know, whatever it was, 3.5 minutes. And so you get all these pop songs that are that length. And we get the LP, you know, which can handle about 44 minutes or whatever it is. And so you get people conceiving of a musical work as being two sides and of roughly 22 minutes each. And, you know, it just goes on and on and on. With every format we've ever had, it's shaped not only the consumption of the music, but the production.
And people are into these very long playlists now too, so they don't have to think. Mm. And the whole idea of a mood playlist too.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm, you know, again, like this is just like where I am right now in my life. I don't know why, but well, first of all, when I'm writing, I can't listen to anything because I'm too interested in sounds. So I just can't. But even when I'm just sort of like hanging out, I just don't listen to music anymore. I listen to music when I want to actively listen to it. And I go to a lot of, you know, shows. I like going to like hear DJs spin like old dub reggae and go dance to stuff like that. But in terms of just like the passive consumption of music, I don't know. I'm kind of over it. It's like it feels the same way for me as the social media stuff. Like I really want to focus on it or just not listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, I listen to so much music, but never in the background unless maybe I'm like cleaning, you know, like doing something like that. But
yeah. Or even, yeah, I mean, there are ways you can be listening, but you can listen pretty deeply while you're cleaning or while you're driving, right? Like those are definitely scenarios where I would listen to music, but yeah, music that I'm going to ignore, I don't know.
So Mac, there's so much we could talk about. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you'd like to talk about?
No, not necessarily.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I didn't ask, which I am curious about, is how did you become a sound scholar? How did you get into this field?
Well, it was a very, very circuitous route. I mean, to give you the really long story, I would say I was blessed to be born and raised in New Orleans, which is a very, very sound-rich, you know, culture. I heard so many, you know, every Mardi Gras, you know, you're a little kid and you're out there and on the parade routes and there's so much music. There's not, you know, there's the high school and college marching bands. There's the smaller New Orleans brass bands. There were like, I mean, the first time I ever heard steel pan music was on a Mardi Gras float that the Coast Guard or the Navy would always do. Even just like local TV commercials, like there would be a commercial for the zoo and it was like the Neville brothers or the Meters who like made the music, like all just incredible funk music, like even on TV commercials, like it was just everywhere. And so I think that kind of opened my ears. And then, I mean, I had just a long journey where I did a lot of things. I lived in East Asia for almost 4 years. I worked for in the early dot-com era. I worked for one of the very first online music stores where we had to find photos and descriptions of all the musical instruments or write them ourselves because none of that existed online. We were kind of inventing the online store. And so that was like a rich musical education and just all these different experiences playing in bands, whatnot, sort of came together when I found myself in my 30s and sort of realizing I was probably never going to make a full living as a musician. And I was trying to figure out something I could do with my life. And I had heard about ethnomusicology. And I was like, oh, well, I used to make field recordings in Asia. I didn't even know that there was a name for that, And so I got into ethnomusicology. I went to the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology at Indiana University, sort of venerable program. Then I realized after I was there are not many jobs in ethnomusicology. Nobody told me this. And the jobs that there are, at least it seemed to me at the time, I would have a much better chance if I could lead a gamelan ensemble or something, which I was totally not qualified to do. In fact, the classes, the music ethnomusicology classes were killing me, like transcription and analysis. Oh my God. I was self-taught guitars who could barely read a note, I was like, so that class was a nightmare for me. So gradually, both due to my interests and I think my strengths and weaknesses, I found myself gravitating towards media studies. And then I kind of discovered sound studies just based on the interests I had, because at the time, people were really interested in fandom, both in, popular music studies, but also in media studies. There was a lot of talk about fandoms and fan cultures. And for whatever reason, maybe I'm just a contrarian, but I was just like, most of the media consumption people do is not a fan relationship. The vast majority of it is something we just kind of have on. And I'm way more interested in what's that all about? Why do we have media on in the background? And what does it do for us? And I started to think about things like my grandmother, when my grandfather died, she stopped sleeping in her bedroom and started sleeping in her living room where the TV was. And she just slept on the sofa for the rest of her life. I'm like, well, what was that TV providing? We think about media and we're like, well, okay, media are technologies that, transmit information. They provide entertainment or inform us in some way. That's what they do, right? I was like, she wasn't getting any of that from the TV. Like it was like the TV was giving her this simulation of a human presence. It was providing sound, like human voices. It was providing a little bit of light. It was like a kind of a warmth to it. It was creating a space. And so I just became really fascinated with this more like ambient way of thinking about media, that media create spaces. And what we like about media is that they help us control the space we're in. So once I was really starting to think about this in this way, I was looking for things to read, and then people turned me on to sound studies and scholars like Jonathan Stern, who very kindly, mentored me from afar, as he did with so many people. Really great sound scholar who, unfortunately, just recently passed away. And yeah, so it was a very indirect way. And in fact, in all of my graduate training and my undergraduate training for that matter, I never had a professor who was a sound scholar. Like that wasn't really quite a thing yet back when. I mean, there were faculty out there, but they were very thinly dispersed around the world.
That's fascinating. Well, thanks for coming on today. It was really, really great to meet you.
Yeah, so nice to meet you. Thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. Keep in mind, I've also linked directly several episodes you'll find interesting in the show notes of this one. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.